True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
How much are your loved ones worth to you? Priceless, right? You can't put a dollar amount on a person's life. But not so for Carl Carlson. There were so many tragedies and coincidences in his life that his second wife suspected him of 2 murders and several instances of insurance fraud. In fact, she became convinced enough to record her conversations with Carlson. Join us at the quiet end for Cashing In. Carl Carlson valued people only for how they could benefit him. Over a span of many years, his family members tried to believe that he was innocent, but there were signs that things just weren't right. As the pieces of his life and the facts of his crimes came to light, a puzzle of sorts began to come together. But before we look at the whole picture, let's look at how these individual pieces add up to 2 of the most unfathomable crimes imaginable.
So we got a nice beer for you today, Jill. It's called Sticky Monkey.
I like the name.
Pretty cool name, isn't it? It's from Firestone Walker Brewing, one of my favorite brewing companies in California. And Sticky Monkey's a beer called a quad. It's a heavy hitter. It's 12.5% alcohol by volume. So in this nice little goblet I have, it's a dark brown beer with just a hint of a head to it. Nice aroma, some brown sugar, vanilla, and bourbon. Even better taste. We got toffee, vanilla, bourbon, and dark fruit, kind of like raisins and plums. Very nice. It's a heavy-bodied sipping beer. So we've got a bottle to split between the two of us. We might want to find someone else. Maybe one of the dogs will help us out, or whoever.
Okay, sounds good. Let's open it up.
Okay.
All right, so things are livening up here a bit at the quiet end because, you know, mainly there's great ventilation here because the front door is more of a garage door. So lots of air going on, lots of people starting to come and drink beer. I've been having a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's like people are emerging from hibernation or something, you know?
It is. It's really nice. So let's begin our story about Carl Carlson. This is a story we've been aware of for quite a while and been wanting to talk about. So I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
Let's do it. We'll start with Christina Carlson, okay?
Sure.
Christina, who's called Chris by her family and friends, was 3 years older than her only sibling, and that was her sister Colette. Colette and Christina were very close as the girls grew up, and they planned for their children to grow up together once they had families. Christina's first marriage had ended recently when she met Carl Carlson. Carl was in the Air Force, and he was stationed in North Dakota. And within months, Christina called her sister to tell her she was in love with Carl. Then a couple months after that, she called Colette to say, "Guess what? I'm pregnant." So things moved pretty quickly. But Christina seemed to be pretty happy, and she and Carl got married with plans to have a family together. Carl came from a well-respected family in Seneca County in the Finger Lakes region of Upper New York State. Carl grew up on a large family farm. He had 5 brothers and 1 sister. His father was a highway official in the county, and Carl had a brother who was a town counselor. Carl wasn't an exceptional student, but smart enough. He joined the Air Force after high school, and he served in the Air Force until 1985.
Yeah, once Carl was out of the service, he and Christina decided to move to his hometown of Seneca Falls, New York. By then, they had a daughter, Erin, and a son named Levi. Without much money, the family drove from North Dakota to New York in an old pickup truck with just the basic belongings, really. Carl's family loved Christina right away, though. She fit right in. She was tiny, just 4'11", but just full of energy. Together, big country guy Carl and petite, cute Christina made a really good-looking couple, and they really seemed to enjoy their time together, joking and laughing most of the time. Christina loved being a mom, After Carl took a job at the local stone quarry, they had a third child they named Katie. So things seemed to be going well. But Carl didn't see his future in quarry work. He wanted more. That's when Christina's father offered him a job in his heating and cooling business in California. So they packed up again. They had their oldest daughter, Erin. They had their son, Levi, and now they had Katie. And they were moving to the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains in Murphy's, California. And Colette was thrilled to have her sister and kids coming to live nearby her, because that's where Christina's family was.
Boy, that's a lot of stuff. North Dakota to Upper New York, then across country to California. Wow.
Yeah, really trying to find their way, I guess. And the Carlson's house in California turned out to be this ramshackle former gold miner's shack in the town of Murphy's. Christina could have justifiably complained and been unhappy in the situation, but she tried to make the best of things. At least she was living close to her sister Colette, and their children could play together and grow up as friends like they'd always wanted. Christina was a great seamstress. She sewed curtains. She also painted and decorated the small bedrooms for the kids. So it wasn't an easy life, not by a long shot. But Christina was one who always tried to see the bright side of things. Her daughters, Erin and Katie, remembered a happy childhood with their mother, but then they remember a tense household when their father, Carl, was home. So things were far from ideal.
Yeah, even though from what I've read and watched, they presented themselves as just this one big happy family.
They did. I think Christina really tried hard, not only to create a good image for other people, but to try and create the best life for her kids.
Sure.
But it wasn't easy, that's for sure.
Well, I guess it's fortunate that they were in the location they were because she had family to support her.
Well, you might think that, but it didn't necessarily work out well.
Well, I know, but be better than being all by yourself in North Dakota.
Well, that's absolutely
true.
Or
New York State.
You're right, yeah.
Colette didn't know Carl very well, but after Christina and her family moved to California, Colette didn't like what she saw of old Carl. Just as an example, Colette purchased one of those glamour shots for Christina for her 30th birthday, you know, kind of tarred up and looked seductive.
Yeah, those were a thing.
But when Carl saw Christina all made up, he called her a whore, and he insisted that she remove the makeup. Jeez. And as for the arguments, when they got out of control, Erin and Katie were often sent to their bedroom by Christina. She felt protective of them, but maybe not protective enough of herself.
Oh, that's for sure, and I think that's true of a lot of moms.
Well, yeah.
They're going to put their kids first.
Kids come first.
But you have to realize that when you let that happen to you, that's not good for your kids either.
Right.
Right.
It isn't. Many times Colette had spoken with Christina about her relationship with Carl. And according to Colette, Christina had been planning to leave Carl, move in with her after the holidays in early 1991.
Right. So this is something Carl would really deny. But Colette would say this was the case.
Yeah.
But there's no way to prove it either way because Christina wouldn't be around to tell anyone what she was planning.
No. Christmas 1990 was the last time Colette would see her sister alive. Just days later, New Year's of 1991, 30-year-old Christina died in the house fire. Turns out that she got trapped in a bathroom that was behind a boarded-up window. And her death seemed to be the result of a series of coincidences.
Yeah, so that day, the children were napping, and Carl was working in the garage, and Christina was taking a bath. Carl said he heard Christina yelling at him to save the children. Then Carl came out of the garage and saw smoke coming from the house. So according to Carl, he ran to his son Levi's room first, and he didn't hear Levi calling him, but he broke the window. He said he managed to pull Levi out of the window. Then he ran to his daughters, Erin and Katie's bedroom window. He said he heard Erin telling Katie, "Daddy's coming." He said that 6-year-old Erin managed to get 3-year-old Katie up on a dresser beneath the window. And by jumping, Carl said that he was able to remove the screen and then the window. And both girls grabbed onto Carl, and he ran the children out to his pickup truck. And then he drove away with the 3 children to the neighbor's house, where he called for help. But of course, he left Christina to die in that fire. It would be way too late for her by the time he got help.
Yeah, so there's a few things that are a little bothersome about this story from Carl. I can't quite picture how he's able to jump up and repeatedly jumping and grabbing at the screen and getting the screen out and then getting the window open.
Right.
That sounds a little far-fetched to me.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things about the story, but I think what was the most upsetting early on for Christina's family was, why didn't he try and save her?
Oh, I know. That'd be the biggest thing.
That is the biggest thing with this story, and we're going to talk a lot about that. Carl claimed not to have heard any screaming from Christina. He said he tried, but he couldn't save her. According to Charles, the bathroom window was boarded up because Christina had accidentally broken it 3 days earlier when it was stuck shut and she had tried to use a plunger to open it. I don't know what kind of sense that makes. Have you ever tried to open a window with a plunger?
I haven't.
Okay. Maybe it's a thing, but I've never heard of it.
So what do? You get it to attach to the window?
I guess you use suction and try and pull it up that way. I mean, I kind of get the idea.
I don't.
Okay.
It's not going to work that way.
No, it doesn't seem like it would be effective because a plunger is not going to work well moving upward like that. Anyway, that's what Carl said. And this boarded up window, of course, is a big issue because that made the bathroom just a death trap. Absolutely a death trap.
Well, it did, because just outside the door of the bathroom is where the fire started. She can't get out the boarded up window and she can't go out the doorway because there's a raging fire out there.
Exactly.
So she's screwed.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot more suspicious about this stick. A jug of kerosene was in the hallway right outside of that bathroom. Carl said that Christina had put the kerosene there, mistakenly believing it was a jug of water.
Please.
Yeah, so there's one thing. Then, he said, either their dog or their cat had accidentally knocked it over and spilled it. Carl had also accidentally put a defective light near the kerosene-soaked carpet, he claimed. And he thought maybe this ignited the fire. Anyway, this would have left the window as Christina's only way out. But it was boarded up, and I mean really boarded up.
Yeah, that wasn't going to move.
And Carl made no effort to break through, later claiming that the fire had overtaken the area by the time he got the children out of the house. But a lot of this doesn't match up to the scene.
You know, Christina had some cousins who lived nearby, and they went to the house and took an extensive video of the scene. Most of the bathroom where Christina had been found was intact, and it looks like if Carl had just knocked out the board that was blocking the window, then saving Christina should have been pretty simple.
Yeah, this was the first floor. It wasn't up high. This was one of the lower windows, actually.
Yeah. The oldest daughter, Erin, watched her father from the truck after he got her out of the fire. She remembered him walking slowly toward the house, and she didn't see him make any efforts to get into that boarded-up window or to break the wood. So even before the firefighters and paramedics arrived, Carl told her and her siblings that their mommy had gone to heaven.
Well, that's another shocking thing to me.
Say, well, that's that.
The fire trucks and the ambulances are not even there yet. And he's telling the kids that mommy's gone to heaven, so that's really jumping the gun. Plus, a lot of people would say that he was so unemotional and inappropriate.
Yes.
After Christina's death, Carl's brother Mike flew out to California from New York to help his brother, who, you know, is now a homeless single father of three. He found Carl pacing outside of the burned-out house. To Mike, Carl seemed lost and in need of support. Many people even saw him as a hero because he did save his children. But then there were many others who wondered how the fire had happened and how Carl could have driven away, knowing that his wife was inside of that blaze. And if you just look at it objectively, without knowing anything about the people or even having any negative beliefs about Carl and who he was and is, it still is very suspicious that it was set up to trap her in there.
It sure looks like that.
So Mike talked to Carl about his future, and Carl decided he wanted to move back to New York with his kids. So this was a blow to Colette, who had just lost her sister and was now having her nieces and nephew move away. And Carl and the kids moved just 4 days after Christina's death.
Well, they didn't waste any time.
No, just enough time to have the memorial service and go. So this was not looked upon well by Colette and Christina's other family members at all.
I'm sure it wasn't.
Plus, he just did not seem as upset as he should have been.
Yeah, you got that, and then you have the history of family arguments, not a happy household. Easy to see why they would be suspicious of her brother-in-law.
Well, yeah, for Colette, she just couldn't get over why he didn't try and break that wood. Right, he had a garage with a workshop that he had just been in. So why couldn't he bring a hammer or something and break that wood?
I know.
Doesn't make any sense. Plus, it was really hammered in there. There were 17 nails used, which seems excessive if you're just temporarily closing off a broken window.
True.
I mean, a lot of people would just duct tape some cardboard over that.
Mm-hmm.
Not board up the entire window. So the whole house was just like a huge fire hazard, and where Christina was just seems like she was caught in a trap.
Yeah, well, that's, like you said, the boarded up window and the fire raging on the other side. Very difficult, if not impossible, to escape that.
Yes, and I can't even imagine how horrible that would be to die that way. It had to be just dreadful. She didn't know where her kids were, if they were safe either. But then, she can't breathe. She had to be calling for help.
Absolutely.
We're assuming that she was conscious and he hadn't done anything to her yet, because it did look like she had tried to get out. So after Carl left California, State Fire Investigator Carl Kent was sent to the house to examine the scene. The first thing he noted was a very strong smell of kerosene in the hallway outside of the bathroom where Christina had died. Also, the entire hallway from the master bedroom to the living room was covered with cardboard. Burn patterns showed that the origin of the fire had been right outside of the bathroom. That area, in fact, was so taken over by fire that there was no way that Christina could have left the bathroom that way. It was just a wall of fire, very quickly. The girls would later say that their mother had covered up that carpet with some towels. So there were towels in the hallway and there were cardboard boxes. It's just almost like a tinderbox, really.
Yeah, they had good fuel for the fire.
Absolutely. So Carl Kent, the investigator, was very skeptical. If Carlson had been able to save his children, why was there no apparent effort on his part to save his wife? He'd been in the garage, so he had some tools. Why didn't he break the wood that was nailed over the window? But the district attorney didn't believe there was enough evidence to prove that the fire was not an accident. Kent disagreed with that. A fatal fire involving an accelerant and a boarded-up window is just the definition of suspicious.
You would think, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Kent asked his supervisor to authorize a flight for him to New York to interview Carlson, which seemed completely reasonable, but he was told they didn't have the funds for that. So Kent had to move on to other cases. But he would never forget about this fire, and he will come back into the story later on.
Yes, he will.
But still, the Carlson fire remained suspicious, and it was officially ruled an accident. And then Carlson collected $200,000 in life insurance from Christina's death. So just pile that onto your stack of suspicious things.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, and then there's another interesting thing about this insurance policy. Carl had taken it out on Christina's life just 20 days before she died. So he gets the money, he moves away just a few days after she dies, after the fire. Sort of suspicious, huh?
It really sounds like the actions of a guilty man to me.
Yeah.
But Carlson was able to explain it in a way that seemed to make sense to at least some people.
Yeah, well, I think they'd be willing to listen to anything that sounded reasonable, because he's a widowed father of three kids. You feel some sympathy for him.
Yes, and I don't think he was really that verbal with people about how much money he got either.
Okay.
So it seemed kind of reasonable. He was left alone with these kids. His family's in New York. But Colette would have happily helped with those children as well. So what was the hurry?
There isn't.
Right. But nonetheless, Carlson had moved his family to Seneca County, New York. But, you know, he seemed easily overwhelmed by the responsibilities of being a single dad. Wasn't good at it, in other words.
Yeah, well, he hadn't been much of a caretaker for them in California. I mean, that was Christina's job.
You're right.
She'd be the one that did just about everything for the children and their home. Carlson's job was to go to work and come home and not do anything.
Yeah, so, well, I don't know about not do anything, but sure.
Minimal.
He wasn't super involved. So when he got to New York, he did get a job at a local glass manufacturing plant, working 5 days a week, and his family helped him out however they could, which was quite a bit. According to the Union Democrat Online News, when a representative from State Farm Insurance questioned Carl about whether he could have done more to save Christina, he went into a bit of a rage. He banged hard on the kitchen table and ran off down a hallway. So it seems like maybe he was protesting too much.
Good quote.
So Heather Gower Small, the former fire claim representative, would later testify that Carl was very angry and that he said to her, "If I had been in it for the money, lady, why not the kids? I'd be a rich man. I'd have millions." And that was a little bit shocking, too, because who would even think of such a thing?
I know. I guess he was, huh?
He was. So there certainly were people who were suspicious, but nothing was going to be prosecuted. He was going to get away with this, if in fact he was guilty.
Yeah, so 3 months after the fire, Gower and another rep sat down with Carl in his family's home in Seneca County. Now, they were still investigating the events of January 1st, 1991. In this interview, Carl said to them, "Being the father of three kids is a bitch." Well, yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, and I don't know. It sounds pretty hard, but that's the kind of guy he was. It's kind of how he spoke. But then at the same time, you think, he just lost his wife 3 months ago. He should be treasuring these children and just so happy that they got out.
No, he's poor me. I got to take care of these kids.
And where's the guilt? Any normal person would feel guilty about this, even if they didn't do it on purpose, right?
Yeah.
You'd say, why didn't I clean that up better? Why didn't I get the window fixed correctly?
Why couldn't I have knocked the plywood off and got my wife out the window? I mean, there's lots of things you're thinking about.
Of course, you'd just be tearing yourself up over it if you were a person who had empathy and was not sociopathic. But he didn't seem to show any of those emotions or concerns.
No, and he gave the investigators this very detailed story of the hours before the fire and the situation in the home that led to the fire, then his actions on the day of the fire when his wife was trapped in the bathroom. The investigators had Carl draw a sketch of the house. That way they could understand the layout of the rooms, the doors, windows, and outlets. So he drew a layout of the house from memory. He explained where the kerosene spill was located. The hallway, he said, had been flanked with about 30 boxes of winter clothing, and they were stacked 2 to 3 boxes high. So good flammable material in there, probably.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Even if you didn't have a homicidal arsonist in your family, this is not safe. And if social services went in and did a check of this house for the well-being of the children, they'd be removed.
Probably.
This is horrible. I understand not having a lot of money, but this is just not safe.
You almost think of hoarders, you know?
Almost. It's just, especially if kerosene did actually spill on the ground, you need to take that seriously. The whole house would reek. And would those fumes be healthy for a 3-year-old and the other kids?
No.
It just doesn't seem reasonable. He was also questioned about why he had purchased life insurance just 3 weeks before the fire.
Yeah, and he told the investigators, well, I was working with Christina's father. I was making $700 to $1,000 a week at that time. And he decided to purchase the policies as an investment for his children's college tuition. And he also said that because they were entering their 30s, it was probably time for them, meaning he and Christina, to have life insurance.
Sure, but the 20 days before the fire, is that what the length of time was?
Right.
That's just too much of a coincidence to be overlooked. And I always thought if you got life insurance, there would be a few months between buying it and between it being payable.
Oh, I don't know.
I guess not.
I don't think so.
That's the way it works with health insurance, usually. You get a job, and your health insurance takes a couple months to kick in.
Sure.
But so, I'm
not sure there's an exact analogy there.
I guess there wasn't, but that was just a belief I held. and I was wrong about it, obviously. So going over that New Year's Day in 1991, Carlson said that he woke up between 5:30 and 6 a.m. and he went to work. Then when he realized that it was a holiday and no one was coming into work, he left and returned home about 9 a.m. Now sure, I've forgotten about my work schedule or a holiday once in a while, but I've never actually gone all the way to work and then realized, oh yeah, I'm not supposed to be working.
Well, particularly New Year's.
Yeah, New Year's is pretty hard to forget, I would think.
Yep.
But he said he got home around 9. Then he watched college football on television, played with the children for a while, and he took down the Christmas tree. The interesting thing about that is the oldest child, Aaron, would later say that her father had doused the tree with gasoline that day and burned it outdoors in front of them. And of course, it had just gone whoosh up in flames. And he said to them, I just want you to see how fast a house can burn. And this is the day that his wife would burn to death. So there's just so many coincidences here.
Boy, I guess.
And while all this was going on, according to Carl, Christine had just been doing laundry and other housework.
Yep, just a little domestic day. Now, as Carl related the events, he said that Christina had brought into the house a 5-gallon, blue-green colored, double-lidded drum of kerosene, maybe a day or two before the house fire, thinking it was water.
Now, why? Why would you think that? They had running water.
Yeah.
So why would you think that this double-lidded drum of kerosene was water? Come on. I don't believe that.
No.
Okay.
And Carlson said he believed either his dog or his cat had knocked the can over and spilled over a gallon onto the floor.
So why was it sitting in the hallway without the lid on? They did have kerosene heaters, so I understand that they would be bringing kerosene into the home, but the rest of it doesn't make sense to me. And according to Carl, Christina had put some kerosene-soaked clothing into their dryer. This was a couple days before the actual house fire, and it had filled the house with fumes and smoke. The smoke detectors had gone off, and he had removed the clothing from the dryer and put the clothes on a living room sofa, and then opened some windows to air it out.
Huh.
Now, when I think of this, I think, was this an attempt? Was this his first attempt? And then 2 days later, he pulled it off?
Could be.
Because that's very suspicious as well. I don't think Christina would put clothing that had kerosene on it in a clothes dryer.
No,
this is making her out to be an idiot, and she wasn't.
You'd run it through the washing machine first.
Well, if that would even work, that kind of stuff doesn't really come out. I think you'd throw them away outside.
Here's one other thing. I mean, there's a 5-gallon drum of kerosene.
Yeah.
It is not light.
No.
And I'm wondering how a dog, or particularly a cat, could knock it over.
That's a good point, Dick. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. A 5-gallon jug weighs a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think you'd have to be intentionally knocking into it to tip it over.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This all seems intentional. None of this stuff seems like it would happen by accident in any natural way.
Well, we're picking up on it because we know the end result of things. But still, if you're an investigator, this is just all sorts of red flags going up.
Well, if I went to visit my friend or something, and this was the situation with the kerosene in the hallway and the boxes and stuff, I'd say something. I'd say, this is just like a tinderbox here that you're living in.
No kidding.
Right? And that's without anyone having any evil intentions.
Jill, hurry up. How are we going to be ready for the 5K if you keep stopping every couple blocks?
I can't help it. Every time I get in the zone and absorbed in a podcast, it's interrupted by advertisements. You know I don't like ads, so I have to stop and fast forward on my phone each time.
Okay, just don't stop in the middle of the street anymore. You're blocking traffic.
Well, my only consolation is that our True Crime Brewery listeners have an ad-free option. By going to our website, tigrever.com, you can subscribe for bonus episodes, ad-free versions of our regular weekly shows, and a gift of TCB merch. Subscribing costs as little as $4 a month.
I know. It's a great deal. But please, let's get back to our run. I've got a bottle of Curio waiting for me at home.
Thank you. So back to New Year's Day then, Carlson said that the children laid down for a nap and he went to do some electrical work in the attic. He realized then that he needed some wires from their detached garage, which also was a workshop, and when asked if the smoke detectors went off at that time, he said he didn't even think about it, so he didn't know.
Nope.
So Carlson had gone to Levi's bedroom window first. He said he broke the window, which caused a backdraft, singeing his face and some of his hair.
And I would just say right now that pictures of him immediately following the fire don't seem to support that.
No, and witnesses also did not see him really have any injuries. He said that he threw Levi, who was 5 years old at the time, about 18 feet across the deck, causing Levi to get a bloody nose. Then, after he got the two girls out through their bedroom window, he drove off to the neighbor's house. He went there to call 911, but he left his wife behind the boarded-up window. I would think that once the children were safe, that's the time to go back and save the wife, not to drive away.
That would seem to be the right time for that.
And this is 91. Most people don't have cell phones, so he would have to get to a phone.
Sure.
But I don't think he should have left the house without her.
You try to save everybody. I mean, if you're believing his story, he's gotten his three kids out and then just forgets about the wife or says, you know, mommy's in heaven now.
Right.
I mean, try to get her out too, right?
Well, I just think driving away from the house is just like signing her death warrant. Because he's driving away, leaving her there, there's no way for her to get out. So the wood, I guess, that boarded up the window was warped, and the boards were nailed right into the wall. So she would never be able to remove this and escape. Of course, she's in the bathroom. She doesn't have tools. And even though there was a neighbor 0.1 miles away, Carlson drove 0.15 miles away to the next neighbor. So another half mile, not a lot, but wouldn't you go to the first place?
Sure. The first house you see.
Yeah. So, of course, he didn't save his wife. Christina would be found doubled over by the bathtub with a wash rag held to her face. She died of smoke inhalation.
So, and when he returned to his burned-out home, Carlson walked around the house and determined there was nothing he could do. He went back to his truck at the end of the driveway where the kids were, waited for the firefighters to come, basically watched other people rush around trying to help.
So that's really weird, right?
Yep.
So there were also some inconsistencies noted in Carl's statements. Carl told the insurance investigators that he had been fixing up the house in lieu of rent. But when the owner didn't refinance the property, he had to begin paying rent. But he was just totally unclear about when he had begun making rent payments and what amount he had paid. It would turn out he was really behind in the rent.
Yeah, quite a bit. Okay, so here he is now, single dad, Seneca Falls, New York, 1992, so a year or over.
Yep.
He's at a country western bar doing some line dancing, and he meets a woman named Cindy Best. They ended up talking a lot that night. Carlson told Cindy his story about losing his wife in a fire, how he had three kids that he was raising by himself, and that his family was raising Belgian horses. So they started dating. Cindy was very drawn to Carl's kids. She thought that she had been unable to get pregnant, and here was a ready-made family. So good deal.
Yeah, I guess her doctors had told her she would probably never get pregnant. So she meets this guy. She likes him. He's got three little kids. It just seemed like this ready-made family for her that she was really excited about.
Well, yeah. I mean, she wanted to be a mom.
Yep.
And here the kids are.
And the kids needed someone, to be honest.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Cindy and Carl then got married in August of 1993. They bought the Carlson old family house from Carl's parents and the farm. And not long after that, Cindy did get pregnant. So she gave birth to a son named Alex, so now they have four children. As Alex got older, he became very close with his siblings, especially Levi. He and Levi used to ride horses together, go fishing, and just hang out around the farm. He was a good big brother, Alex would say. But, you know, it wasn't an easy life for the Carlson kids. Carl was a very strict disciplinarian. All of the kids had chores to do for hours each day, Even the little kids did laundry, cooking, mopping, and worked on the farm. And as the older boy, Levi really got the brunt of Carl's aggression. He was really expected to act like a grown man from a very early age. So there was definitely tension between Levi and his father.
Yes, there was. Christina's sister, Colette, living across the country in California, still tried to maintain some closeness with her nieces and nephews. They did visit the farm, so she saw them, and she would call at least a couple times a week to talk to the kids and talk to Carl.
And all this time, she's still suspicious about her sister's death.
Yeah, she's still got that bad feeling.
Of course. So once Levi became a teenager, he became a bit of a rebel. He wasn't a bad kid, but he didn't want to follow in his father's footsteps, and there was a lot of arguing back and forth between Carl and Levi. So he was only 16 when he moved away from home and dropped out of school, and he spent the next several months staying with various relatives, kind of couch to couch. His relationship with his father really went downhill quickly, and they fought more and more. So Carl was very critical of Levi, but to Cindy, he was just a typical teen, you know, thought he knew everything, and didn't want to listen to the adults.
Right.
But he wasn't breaking the law or doing anything horrible.
Yeah, she didn't see any horrible things about it, just that he was a teen.
Yeah, yep.
Now we're going to fast forward a little bit. We're going to go up to November 2002, because that's when another deadly fire came into Carlson's life. So it's nighttime. He's just about getting into bed with Cindy. Carlson looked out the window and told Cindy to call 911. The barn was on fire. And it was raging. Huge fire. There were three Belgian horses in the barn, a mare and her two babies, and they all died in the fire.
So that's horrible.
Isn't it?
It's not a person, but it still is very traumatic and sad. Very sad.
Oh, definitely. Carl suggested that an old radio may have set off a spark and set some hay on fire. It sounds about as plausible as the other fire.
Yeah, really.
Cindy called up Carl's brother Mike, and he rushed over. So they were pretty upset to have the family horses die in such a horrible way, because they were locked in the barn, there wasn't any way out, and Carl didn't really make any attempt to try to get them out.
Yeah, it's not like he saw the fire and ran out to the barn.
No.
He said, call 911, there's a fire, and just kind of stood there. So this was upsetting, and it also just piles on to that other fire, and you think, well, who has two fires like that? I guess it could certainly happen, but it's a little bit strange.
Well, there's more strangeness, too, that we'll talk about.
Absolutely. Many of the Carlson family members were very upset about these horses. The barn was fully engulfed in flames by the time the fire department got there, but Carl didn't seem especially upset. Within a couple of days, the barn was leveled and the horses' bodies were hauled away and buried. To his brother Mike and to his wife Cindy, Carl just seemed like he was anxious to get it cleaned up and move on. Like it was just another step in what had to happen.
So, of course, there's an investigation into the fire, and it was ruled to be an accident fairly quickly. But like the first fire with Christina, there were suspicions. Stories tough to swallow. And then we find out that there's another fire. This is from many years ago. 1986, Carl had been almost bankrupt, and his new Ford Mustang caught fire in his driveway. So he collected $10,000 in insurance money for this. And one of the things that was noted when the Mustang caught fire, Carl had removed all his belongings from the car.
Yeah, so this was just kind of spontaneous combustion in the driveway of a brand new car?
Yep.
I'm really surprised that they paid the insurance easily.
I am too.
So Carlson had been months behind on his rent in 1991 when Christina died in the suspicious house fire, trapped in that bathroom that Carlson had boarded up just days earlier. He then had collected $200,000 in life insurance that he had bought, would you say, 20 days earlier?
Yeah.
About 3 weeks?
3 weeks.
In 2002, Carlson had removed four custom horse harnesses from that barn and put them in the house. So this was just before that barn burned to the ground. Just over 2 weeks earlier, Carlson had increased his insurance policy on the barn from $20,000 to $115,000. So he collected the entire amount on that.
Seems like there's a pattern emerging here, huh?
Absolutely. And some people were starting to notice.
Yeah, one of those was his son Levi, and he talked to his stepmom, Cindy, about this. And then when Carl confronted Levi about what he was saying, they ended up in a physical fight, an actual physical fight, not just verbal. So Levi left the house, drove away, and didn't speak to his father for some time. But with time, Levi got back into his family's lives, although he never really got much closer to his father. There was some issues still that remained there.
Well, sure.
Right?
Well, you have to think if Levi was expressing suspicion about the barn fire, there must have been at least some part of him that believed his father had murdered his mother in the fire in California.
You got it.
And how can you have a good relationship with your father if you think he killed your mother?
It would be difficult.
It would be.
Levi ended up getting married to his longtime girlfriend. He's like 17 or 18. They had two daughters together. One when Levi was 18 years old and the second when he was 20 years old. So like a lot of young marriages, it didn't last. But Levi worked hard to be a good father. He got his GED, he got a good job, and he contributed to the care of his daughters.
Yeah, the divorce was actually very difficult for Levi because he really loved his wife. She was his best friend, and he didn't want the separation or the divorce. But then in early 2008, his life was on the upswing. He got a job at a local factory that paid better, and it also gave him insurance for his children so he could support them and take care of them the way he wanted to. But then, on November 20th, 2008, tragedy struck again.
Yeah, Levi was over at his father's farm working on an old Chevy pickup that Carl kept in the barn. The front wheels had been removed from the truck, and it was jacked up just with this wobbly little jack. And if the jack was going to malfunction or break, there weren't any blocks or anything to keep the truck supported.
No, so this is interesting. At first, when I was doing research on this case, I watched an episode on Dateline about it, and it was great. It gave me quite a bit of information, actually. But then I found an episode of 2020, which is something I don't normally watch, but it was very good because they actually went to a junkyard, found a very similar truck, and set up the similar situation so we could actually see it. And it was very precarious. This big truck up on a jack, you could just touch it and it would wobble.
Yeah, great.
And super heavy. Of course, the older vehicles were even heavier.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just another death trap.
Cindy and Carl had been at a funeral for a family member. Then they returned from the funeral. 4 hours later, Cindy felt like something wasn't right because Levi's car was still out front. He should have been long gone. So while Cindy goes into the house, Carl went into the barn to check on Levi. And then the next thing Cindy knows is Carl's running up to the house, banging on the window and door. He told Cindy, call 911. So the truck had fallen onto Levi, and he was trapped under it. Carl had found him there. Now, his whole chest basically was crushed, and he had probably been dead for hours. He was taken to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. He was 23 years old.
Isn't that awful?
So there was a cursory investigation into Levi's death, and there wasn't any autopsy, and his death was treated pretty much like an unfortunate accident.
Yeah, I don't know if an autopsy would have helped anyway, because we know what the cause of death was.
Yeah.
We just didn't know if it was homicide or an accident.
Right.
But they went ahead and treated it like an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Carl's brother Mike went into the barn after Levi had been taken away, and he could see that the truck had been jacked up in this very precarious way. No blocks were under it, and it was only the flimsy car jack holding it up. Mike wouldn't believe that Levi would have been so careless. He'd been working on cars for years, and he knew what he was doing.
One would think.
On the day of Levi's death, Carl's reaction really seemed over the top, too, to Cindy, like he was acting. She would say he totally lost it, and he was throwing himself against the wall and banging his head. So Cindy, too, was beginning to have concerns about what Carl was up to and if the rest of the family was safe. Carl now had experienced a car fire, a house fire, a barn fire, and the deaths of his wife and his son. In each case, he'd collected insurance money. Now, in 2008, Carl had again had money problems. The money he'd collected from the fires and the death of Christina had already been spent. 2 weeks before Levi's death, Carlson took Levi to an insurance office where he gave the New York Life Insurance Company a $470 check for a $700,000 life insurance policy on Levi. And Carlson was the sole beneficiary.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he goes through the $200,000 or so from his wife's death fairly quickly, you need to have more. So $700,000 sounds like a good number.
Well, yeah. I mean, at this point, he's really treating property and family members like a means to an end, just to get what he wants. And that's what makes this case one of the most twisted ever.
Doesn't it? There's some interesting stuff, though, about this. Levi actually had a condition that made it difficult to swallow food, and he had been treated for that. So the insurance policy would likely have been canceled or would have had to be rewritten after a medical exam was done, because they didn't know about it, and neither Carl nor Levi told the agent about the swallowing condition. And actually, his medical exam was scheduled for the day after he had died. Now, even though Levi never had the medical exam, the insurance company still paid out the money to Carl.
That's just so suspicious. I think it's even more suspicious than Christina's death.
Oh, absolutely.
So Carl got this check for $707,210, his biggest payoff yet by far. That was a $400,000 policy for Levi's death and an additional $300,000 in change because it was an accidental death. The death was initially ruled an accident, but Levi's sisters believed that their father was responsible. His second wife, Cindy, remembered that before they left for the relative's funeral that day, Carl had gone back into the barn to check on Levi. So he'd been in there for a couple minutes. So she began to wonder if Carl had actually pushed the truck onto his own son before they even left. So another really suspicious thing is that Levi had left behind a handwritten will. The will read that his father would be the sole executor of his estate and that he would be in charge of distributing money to his children. As remember, he has two little daughters. But Carl told Cindy and the rest of the family that Levi had barely enough money to pay for his funeral expenses. So soon, Carl did tell his wife Cindy about the $700,000 policy, but he didn't tell anyone else. And he made out like Levi's ex-wife couldn't be trusted with any of the money, and that's why he was in charge of it. At the time of his death, Levi and his father seemed to be getting along better, so Cindy said that's why she didn't question it. But the handwritten will had been notarized on the same day that Levi had died. That very same day.
Wow.
So I don't know what to think about Cindy, but we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, so Cindy was getting depressed and uneasy because she's starting to have these thoughts that she didn't want to have, but she's thinking that Carl's involved in some stuff. And at the same time, his brother Mike is beginning to question Carl's behavior as well. Levi had been around the same age as Mike's kids, and he was pretty devastated by his nephew's death. Carl never said much to Mike about Levi's death, and Mike didn't see a grieving father like he had expected. When he saw Carl at the hospital the day Levi died, all that Carl said to Mike was, "How do I explain this?" Yeah. You don't.
Isn't that just awful? So Mike and Cindy, neither of them want to think these things about Carl, but it's kind of hard not to at this point. He's not making it easy to trust him. There was just so much tragedy in Carl Carlson's life. But then he always seemed to bounce back quickly. He read in a magazine article about a man in New York City who was looking for farmers in upstate New York to raise gourmet ducks for restaurants. And this wasn't long after Levi's death. Carl got really excited about this and decided to start his own business raising these ducks. So he bought all these ducks. He started raising thousands of them on his farm. He didn't really know what he was doing, and people wondered where he was getting all the money to buy all these ducks and all the duck feed and everything that was required. He and Cindy were even featured on an episode of the show Pitching In, which was on the Food Network. And Carl had these grand ideas that he was going to be rich and famous, I guess. He really enjoyed all the attention, Cindy would say. But Cindy continued to feel depressed and uneasy. She started having panic attacks and anxiety, but wasn't really sure why. Then, over time, she began to really feel convinced that Carl was responsible for Levi's death. She wasn't sure if she could believe his story. Carl's brother Mike had these same fears, but he didn't share them with Cindy. But it turned out that Cindy was so distressed, she began to feel physically ill, and then she began to drink to excess as well. Finally, she reached the conclusion that Carl had killed his wife and his son, and she was afraid for her own safety. She decided to hire a private detective to find out how Carl was spending that $700,000. Now, she would say this, but detectives involved in the case would say that Cindy was spending some money pretty well also, and that's what makes me a little iffy about her. But Cindy explained to the PI about her concerns that Carl might be responsible for Levi's death. She explained that, before they left for the funeral that day, Carl had spent a few minutes in the barn with Levi. She was beginning to believe that Carl had actually killed him. She didn't want to believe that she was married to a monster, but she just couldn't seem to see any other way now. Crushing his own son for insurance money seemed like the evilest act a person could ever commit. Still, she'd become afraid of her husband. She'd even begun sleeping with a knife under her pillow.
Huh. So this private investigator is named Steve Brown, and he suggested to Cindy that he go undercover, acting as a promoter for Carl's duck business. So they set up a meeting at the farm. Carl met with Brown, certainly enjoying the attention, showing off his duck business. One time, according to Brown, Carl showed him a new electric knife that he had purchased for killing the ducks. He then said, "I like to do it the old-fashioned way, messy and very physical." Not only that, as he's talking about it, he tipped Brown's neck back in motion with his hand as if he was slitting the throat, his throat, which certainly made Brown uneasy. And he believed that Carlson was just this very cold fish who enjoyed violence.
Well, he seemed to portray that, didn't he?
He certainly did.
I would be super uneasy if someone did that to me. Not very happy about the duck killing, to be honest with you.
I didn't think you would be.
But Brown was gathering information in hopes that he and Cindy could go to the police with what they knew. But then a cousin of Cindy's, who she had confided to about her fears, called the police herself. And the detective ended up calling Cindy after talking to her cousin. And Cindy was actually very relieved to hear from the police. The detective would say the first thing she said to him was, "Thank God you called." So it's just a little strange she didn't have, what, the nerve, the bravery, the courage to go to the police herself?
Yeah, but someone else did it and she's all set.
And she was happy about it,
yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a little on the fence about Cindy. But okay, she did at least talk to the police about it. But you also have to think, was this about her real concerns about Carl killing his first wife and son, or is she more concerned that she might be next? I mean, it was really about self-preservation, if you look at it that way.
Well, it probably is. I mean, I can see where she'd be suspicious. And if you follow that storyline, then she could be in danger.
Right, exactly. So she told the detective about the life insurance payout that Carl had collected after his son's death. Carl had been the only beneficiary, not Levi's two young daughters. An investigation into the finances showed that Carl and Cindy had spent a great deal of that money already. And not one dime, nothing, had gone to Levi's ex-wife or children. They didn't even know the money existed. So how can you be that horrible?
Well, it's a rhetorical question.
Well, it's pretty fucking selfish. $700,000, regardless of how they got it, still not to try and take care of the kids.
That's his grandkids.
It's all very sick.
Yes, it is.
You know, this money had just been spent on many things, and all for Cindy and Carl, to be honest. home improvements, vehicles, and then that stupid duck business.
Yeah, then Cindy learned that Carl had taken out insurance policies on her life and on Levi's daughters' lives.
So who gets insurance policies on their granddaughters?
And guess who's the sole beneficiary?
Carl Carlson.
You got it. So if Cindy died, Carl would collect $1.2 million.
Yeah.
Plus, he would inherit 100% of their assets. So at this point, Cindy's pretty much afraid that Carl is lining her up to be the next death. So she took her son Alex and moved to Kentucky. She's going to go live with a cousin. So she was avoiding Carl, not taking any calls or anything like that, while she and Alex were staying in hotels.
Yeah, the other children were grown up by now.
Yeah, so then Cindy figures, maybe I can try to get him to confess. I'm going to record some conversations with him. So first she tried to get him to confess to the barn fire that killed the horses. That, to her mind, would show that he had committed insurance fraud and give the police evidence of his character. Then maybe she could get Carl to confess to Levi's murder.
Yeah, so Cindy agreed to meet Carl for lunch in November 2012, so some time has passed, a few years.
4 more years.
Before she got around to this. And she did plan to record their conversation with a small voice recorder that she had hidden in her bra. So over lunch, she told him that she was considering getting back together with him. But before she could even consider that, he needed to tell her the truth about everything, because she knew that he had lied to her about several things during the marriage. And he seemed to believe this. His response caught her off guard a bit, though. He skipped right over the barn fire and said, "It sounds like you want me to say that I had something to do with Levi's death." So she asked him what happened in the barn with Levi that day. And she asked if it was hard to push the truck. And he said no. So Cindy took this as at least a partial confession. But it was far from enough. And when she took the recording to the police, it was inaudible anyway.
So then the detective asked her if she would want to try it again. This interview would be done under controlled circumstances. But it was still a potentially dangerous situation. But Cindy knew that Carl was believing a story that she gave him of just needing to know before they could be reunited as a couple. So I don't know that I'd feel that confident that it was okay. He doesn't suspect anything. But
well, I mean, at this point, what really choice does she have? And it is going to be more difficult because she's going to want him to repeat things he's already said.
Yeah.
And then that made him a little bit more suspicious of her. But she went ahead with it. She went to meet Carl at another restaurant wearing the police wire. 4 undercover detectives were in the restaurant posing as diners. And Cindy tried to get Carl to repeat what he had told her the last time. But he was really a little hesitant. He said he felt like he was walking into a booby trap. But Cindy was pretty calm. She did well. She offered to let him check her purse for a recorder. And that seemed to satisfy him a bit. Cindy told him that she had asked before if he had pushed the truck, and he had said that he did. But then he denied it. He told her that he had said that he did not push the truck onto Levi. He had said that he didn't set it up that way, but when he was in the barn, he saw the opportunity.
Well, I could have done it, but I didn't do it.
Right. But he wouldn't confirm that on tape. He did say that he took advantage of the situation after it happened.
Okay.
Which is just ridiculous, crazy.
Yes.
What parent would ever say that? And just with a straight face, like, didn't even faze him. And this ended up being enough for at least detectives to bring him in and question him. The interviewing detective soon discovered that Carlson didn't have a conscience to use to get a confession, but he did have a big ego. So they got him to continue talking with them by appealing to his ego and allowing him to speak about what they called his favorite topic, himself. So they were relieved that he didn't hire an attorney, and he continued to talk. A little bit surprised about that as well. But he was just a chatterbox.
Well, again, he's one of these guys that thinks he's the smartest one in the room, and he doesn't need no stinking attorney.
Right, you're right.
So Carl went over the day of Levi's death with the detectives, and he said something that they found to be indicative of a motive. He said, "You don't kill your son for money, you don't kill anyone for money." Now, they hadn't even mentioned the insurance payout, So the police looked at this statement as an indication that Carl had killed Levi for the insurance money. And they thought that they were on the right track. So they appealing again to Carlson's ego, trying to get him to talk about himself. The cops said that they respected him for being in the military. Now, he still wouldn't confess or give anything. So a New York State police detective took over, acting as the bad cop. And he was trying to press Carlson on Levi's death. So after hours of talking, Carlson came out with a second version. Bad news. Don't ever change your story. Came out with a second version of what had happened that day. He said that Levi had been crushed before he and Cindy left the property, and he had just left him there to die. Wow. But initially, he wouldn't reveal a motive. He just said that he panicked and left the barn with Levi inside beneath the truck. So that was bad enough. But
sure.
After more prodding, he went even further. He admitted that he didn't just find Levi under the truck and kind of danced around the question of maybe he might have caused the truck to fall. He claimed that he had climbed out into the truck to get some blankets, and that's when the truck fell onto Levi. Okay.
So the story was definitely changing as time went on, but it was all going to the same place, and that was his guilt. So he was arrested, and he was charged with second-degree murder. Still, if you think about all the stories of what happened to Levi that day, to me it seems certain that his murder had been planned by Carl. I can't think of much worse than killing your own child to collect some money.
Right, but that's how it's presented, right?
Yeah, it actually reminds me of a wonderful classic line from Fargo the movie. What did Marge Gunderson say to the killer once she had him under arrest in her cruiser? Something about money?
There's more to life than a little money, you know. Don't you know that? How's my Minnesota accent?
It's terrible. I love you, but that's really bad. But I think you're right about the line.
The line is correct.
Yes. So Carlson would try and back out of his confession. Months later, when he was arraigned, he actually pleaded not guilty. In an interview with the Post Standard, recorded from jail, Carlson blamed his arrest on Cindy just being a vindictive wife. But then, right when his trial was to begin, Carlson pled guilty to depraved indifference murder in the second degree. And in exchange for that plea, he got the minimum sentence, which was 15 years to life, so still a significant sentence.
Potentially. I mean, you look and say, well, he could get out in 15 years, or maybe a little less than 15 years. Or he could be in for life.
Yeah, exactly. There's a big range there, but I think someone like him would not really appeal to the parole board very well.
I know. So the Seneca County Sheriff went on TV and actively encouraged the California authorities to prosecute Carlson for his wife Christina's death. And once California heard about what Carlson had done to Levi, they opened a murder investigation. Uh-huh.
Well, remember, back in 1991, fire investigator Carl Kent had believed that the fire that killed Christina was arson. But his bosses back then had told him not to pursue it. So now when the case was reopened, investigators contacted Kent and asked him what he remembered about that fire investigation. And it was actually still at the forefront of his mind. Kent had actually believed that the case would come around again someday, either from statements from the Carlson children or some other relatives. He thought this was not something that was just behind them. He told the investigators, yes, he remembered the fire very well. It had been a fire that he had seen as suspicious. And when Kent left his job at the California Department of Forestry, he had taken two boxes of transcripts and tapes, and he'd stored them in his home basement to keep them from getting destroyed. And this turned out to be essential, because all the other information that had been stored in the police evidence room had been disposed of years earlier.
So a prescient move.
Yes, he really saved the day here.
So they're looking into the contents of Kent's boxes, and the investigators also talked to surviving family members and witnesses. And they also reviewed Levi's murder case. So this all came to a head in August of 2014 when Carlson was charged with first-degree murder for Christina's death. Her sister Colette, who had been suspicious of Carlson for years, was happy that he had been charged, but she was also adamant that the case move along swiftly. For an example, when the extradition of Carl from New York stalled, Colette was a strong advocate for Christina's case, and that finally in 2016 he was extradited to California to go on trial.
Yeah, but then he sat in jail for another 4 years before the trial began.
Yeah, so we're right into recent history.
Yeah, 2020.
So it actually turns out to be close to 30 years after Christina's death that he finally went on trial for killing her. The jury was shown a video of the burned-out house, which included images of the boarded-up window. And according to the prosecution, Carlson had trapped Christina, set the house on fire, and left her to die. She was in that bathroom alone, naked, clinging to a wash rag, and dead from smoke inhalation.
So these aren't only murders. These are cruel, painful deaths that he put on his relatives.
They certainly are.
There's not much worse than dying in a fire, really. It's just a horrible, horrible thought. The New York detectives who worked on Levi's case were brought to California to testify about Carlson's confession to Levi's murder. One detective testified to the fact that, in his court elocution, Carlson had admitted that Levi was still alive when they'd left for that funeral that day. So an elocution, which I didn't know what it was, so I wrote down the definition here. It's a formal statement made to the court by a defendant who has been found guilty prior to his being sentenced.
Okay. So that means that Carlson had left his own son under a truck to die.
Yes. Yes, he had. For money.
Now, because this was considered a pattern case, most of the videotape of Carlson's interrogation by New York detectives got to be played for the California jury. And it turned out that a big part of the conversation when he was interrogated in New York was about the California fire. They had asked Carl about the boarded-up window, and he told them that he had boarded up the bathroom window months before the fire. So it wasn't like the glass just broke the day before or anything like that. At the same time, though, Christina's sister, Colette, remembered that the window had not been boarded up when she saw her sister on Christmas 1990. So it actually turns out that the window had been boarded up just a few days before the fire.
Yeah, so he's just trying to distance it out and make it look less suspicious.
Right.
But we have proof that that wasn't true. Carlson had also told the detectives that he'd suffered severe injuries when he saved his children from that fire. He said when he broke Levi's window, a fireball burned his face and threw him onto the deck. But a paramedic from the scene testified that Carlson had no treatable injuries, and she didn't see any injuries on him, no burns or anything. He may have had some tiny abrasions, but also the paramedic remarked that he was very calm and unconcerned, and that stayed with her. She never forgot that.
And then Colette testified about something that Carlson had told her after Christina's death. Colette had told him she wanted to see her sister, and Carl told her that she couldn't because her sister was a crispy critter. Now, this brought some audible gasps from the jury when that was said.
That's such a horrible thing to say, and to say it to her sister is just crazy. And I think there was another case where a murderer made a remark like that about one of his victims. Ringing a bell in my head somewhere.
Okay.
But, of course, it's a horrible thing to say. And I believe Colette, she had no reason to make that up. I mean, I think it was painful for her even to repeat it in the courtroom. This is her sister. So Carlson's callousness was really a big focal point for the prosecutors. That was just part of it. Family members testified to being really troubled when Carl suggested a sightseeing trip right after Christina was killed. So they'd gone and they'd visited the Big Trees Park, and right after that, Carlson decided to move back to New York. So it really seemed like he wanted to get away and avoid Christina's family.
Certainly does.
And I think most of them did suspect him pretty early on. We know that Colette did. So at the trial, the prosecution also put a forensic electrical engineer on the stand, and this was someone who specializes in fire causes and origins. This engineer had been asked by the insurance company back in 1991 to investigate the fire for a trouble light. So the trouble light was supposed to be a key piece of evidence in determining the cause of the fire. Carlson had claimed to have accidentally placed a defective electric light too close to the kerosene-soaked carpet. So, another thing I learned researching this case is what a trouble light is. Did you know what that was?
No, you're going to tell me, though.
Well, it seems to be one of those workman lights. You know, when a workman's painting drywall, they hang those lights?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that seems like that's what it was. This engineer had gone to the scene of the fire a few weeks after, and he had been unable to find any ignition source. Wiring in the house had not started the fire, nor had any appliances. The trouble light that Carl had been talking about had been severely burned, but then investigators were able to determine by looking at the filament that the light had not been energized at the time of the fire, meaning that the light wasn't on, so it couldn't have ignited the fire. So we have no ignition source, which is a problem. So then, the investigator looked at the kerosene stains. So Petz may have knocked over a container filled with kerosene days before the fire, but he saw evidence of a second, very deliberate spill pattern. He saw a distinct pour of kerosene in a U-shape right outside of that bathroom door and going around to the laundry room across the hall. He testified that someone had poured that kerosene and lit it on fire. He was sure of that. And he had notified the insurance company actually back in 1991, and I don't know why they decided to pay the claim anyway.
Yeah, I don't know.
The insurance companies just seem to pay these off pretty easily. In every instance, which surprises me.
Well, this story surprises me because it seems like there's plenty of red flags.
You have experts, yes.
Yeah. Also in the trial, Erin, the oldest child, testified. She's now 36 years old. And she testified about visiting her father in jail before his conviction in Levi's death. And during that visit, she told Carlson that she had made up her mind that he had killed Levi and Christina. And she told him that she knew he had killed both of them. And then, according to her, Carlson grinned like a Cheshire cat and replied, "It's been 20 years. They haven't caught me yet, and they're not going to."
Huh. Well, yeah. So his daughters definitely believe he's guilty. The prosecution identified a pattern of insurance schemes by Carlson, including the 1986 car fire, the 1991 house fire, the barn fire that killed his horses in 2002, and then the 2008 freak accident that killed Levi. So each of these incidents had resulted in financial payouts to Carlson, actually kind of increasing over time.
Yeah.
Because then with Cindy, he would have gotten $1.2 million if he was planning to kill her, which we don't know. But if I was her, I'd certainly be concerned about that. So what the prosecution did for the jury is they went back to 1990 and they broke down a timeline. So let's go over the timeline a little bit because there's some more information we haven't covered in that.
Okay.
So December 7th, 1990, Carlson got his regular paycheck and a Christmas bonus. On December 12th, he went out and bought life insurance on Christina, the children, and himself. On December 30th, the first kerosene spill happened, and he hammered a board 17 times over the broken bathroom window. That same day, he confirmed with his closest neighbor that they wouldn't be home. Then, on January 1st, Christina died in that house fire. That same day, Carlson spoke with a family friend named James Roberts and told him that he didn't know if Levi had been able to get out, so that contradicted his story that he had saved Levi by breaking the bedroom window, and that he had been hit in the face with a fireball.
And so Carlson didn't testify in his own defense. The defense actually called just two witnesses, and their defense lasted 2 days. They argued that Carlson's representation of the fire was consistent, and any inconsistencies were due to the years between Christina's death and the investigation. His lawyer said that the prosecution was indicting Carl in the death of his wife, simply because of the circumstances of Levi's death.
Well, and you know, a lot of the case was stuff from Levi's death, but if you're thinking of a pattern case, that is allowed.
Right.
The defense called the prosecution's case schizophrenic and dependent on biased witnesses. They claimed that the case the prosecution presented was based on old evidence and there's nothing new to justify a conviction at that point. The forensic investigator was criticized, too, for not seeing the fire scene until weeks after the fire, and then they used the fact that the insurance paid out to say that the insurance company was not concerned that these were not accidents.
Right. So after 2 days of deliberation, Carlson was found guilty of murder in the first degree, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He'll serve the remainder of his 15-year-to-life sentence for the 2008 second-degree murder of Levi in a New York State prison, and then he'll be sent to a California state prison when his prior sentence is completed. Carlson's exhausted all of his appeals on the New York conviction, and his attorney has said that they plan to appeal the California conviction. So he's continuing to try.
Well, almost all of the money from the life insurance payouts is actually gone, if you can believe that. According to the financial advisor who sold Carlson the policy on Levi in 2008, Carl Carlson and his second wife, Cindy, took all the money in what the advisor called a feeding frenzy. So what do we think about Cindy? Why was she spending that money? I almost feel like she was enjoying the money.
I'll bet she was.
And that might have put off her going to police. I don't want to point fingers at her, but you know, the daughters, Aaron and Katie, certainly do not have great feelings about Cindy's behavior.
Well, it is kind of suspicious, although I think it's, you know, he gets the 700 grand, he's spending money, and she's going to get in on it a little bit and enjoy some largesse here.
Yeah, but this is from his child dying.
I know.
Who wants to spend that money?
Well,
it's like blood money.
She does.
Well, and that's what I don't like, because she wasn't his biological mother, even though that doesn't matter, but she did raise him even, so he was like a son to her.
Yep.
So I guess it's good that she was willing to do the recording, and maybe it wasn't a conscious decision, is another thought I've had. Maybe she was just kind of going along and not letting it come to the forefront in her thoughts. And that's why it was kind of internalized and causing the panic and the anxiety and the illness.
I could understand that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Carlson's assets, according to court documents, totaled $219,281 in 2019. And most of that, $164,000, is from the value of the family farm that he bought that's now deserted. So where did all the money go?
Well, how much did that duck business cost?
Probably a lot.
I'll bet that was a significant amount of money.
I think that was, yeah.
And he never really got that off the ground and never started making money from it, really.
I don't think so. From what I heard about it, it sounds like he was just enjoying all the attention and spending the money. And even his brother Mike said that he was kind of a schemer all his life.
Yeah.
So our sources for this case are the Union Democrat articles by Giuseppe Ricapito in 2019 and 2020. There's the Dateline episode titled The House on the Hill. There's the 2020 episode, which is titled The Sins of the Father. That's season 42, episode 27. Boy, those true crime shows have a lot of seasons, don't they?
Well, maybe they have three seasons in a year or something like that.
They'd have to.
I can't believe that it's 42 seasons.
Well, 2020's been around a long time.
True.
Another source was the Syracuse Post-Standard Archives from 2014 to 2020. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. And Dick, we have feedback today. What have you got?
I have, for today, I have one voicemail and I think a couple emails. So the voicemail is from Rebecca, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, guys. My name is Rebecca, and I love, love, love your show. Thank you so much for coming and putting out all of these episodes. It is definitely something that gets me through some of these crazy times. But I also maybe wanted to tell you about a crime that you guys might be interested in covering. I went to high school in a really small town in Missouri. The name is Mexico. Yes, Mexico. And it was, I mean, it's a really great community. And there was a restaurant there called G&D Steakhouse that was very, very popular. There was a wonderful Greek family who owned it. You know, the father was the one who was always there. He knew everybody who came in. He had these really corny little pranks that he would play on everybody. He was amazing. I went to high school with his younger son, Andy. Anyways, so this is several years later. I am living in another town and I hear about this horrible crime. Gus Corellis, the gentleman who owned the restaurant, that restaurant was one of the only places that you could work before 16. He would always be willing to help people out, have them come in, wash dishes, clean, take out trash, that kind of stuff. So I had heard that there was this incident at G&D Steakhouse, and I started calling a friend, and it turns out Gus Corellis was shot to death. He was shot to death, and his place was robbed. The killers, one of them was a former employee who I think got fired or quit. I can't remember. But him and a friend went to rob him. They found him. I don't know if they meant to shoot him, but they did. And then they took off, and there were a lot of people who were involved in kind of the cover-up. They had a girl who was like in the getaway car. There was an aunt of one of the boys who took them in and helped them burn their bloody clothing. And then the boys, I guess, took the money and just kind of went on this spending spree around the state. They were finally caught and tried. I can't remember what the outcome was. I think they might have gotten life in prison. But it's a terrible, terrible crime to a fabulous man and family in a small town. And I think it would be great to have him remembered. Thanks.
Thanks, Rebecca. I just want to say it's really nice that she would like him to be remembered. And that's a reason for having a case suggestion. Isn't it? It's really nice.
Well, the kids that were convicted were like 18 years old, just kids. But, just something that wasn't expected.
Well, sure. Yeah.
Wow. So I thought I'd look stuff up and see if we want to do that.
Sure. If we can get enough information on it, I'd be happy to do it. I'm always in favor of doing the cases that aren't heard of much because I do feel like victims deserve that, deserve to be remembered. Of course, they deserve justice for what happened to them, but they also deserve to be remembered for what they did that was good in their life. And it sounds like this man did some good stuff.
He did.
Yeah. Okay, our next piece of feedback is an email from Anna, or Anna. So Anna writes, "Hi guys, I have a case suggestion for you, a tragic mass murder that took place in Calgary in April 2014. It's the case of Matthew DeGrude, who stabbed and killed 5 fellow students at a University of Calgary house party. He was later diagnosed with schizophrenia and found not criminally responsible. I remember following the case when it happened and recently watched a Crime Beat 2-part series on the circumstances, and the whole thing is almost unbelievable and sad. I'd love to hear you wonderful people tell the story of the 5 victims and to hear Dick's take on DeGrude's mental illness. If you need a beer recommendation, check out SYC Brewing, located in Edmonton. I'm a big fan of their pineapple FOMO sour, but they also have lots of good options. Thanks for always putting out such great podcasts, and stay safe." Well, thank you, Anna. That's really nice of you to say we have great podcasts. That made my day. What do we know about the case, Dick?
Well, the only thing I really got was that, and the reason I included it, was that he actually was successful in the mental illness, not guilty by mental illness.
Oh, which is really rare. Yeah, you're really interested in that.
Which is pretty rare. So I thought that might be something to look into.
Yeah, absolutely. And the pineapple sour, fear of missing out sour, sounds delish.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, so I'd like to do the case and the beer. Can you make that happen?
Sure.
All right, great. And one more email today, and this one's from Kate.
I got an email from Kate. So she says, "Thank you for keeping me company on so many walks and runs with my dog, Rogan. I've enjoyed each of your shows. I have a Richmond, Virginia case and an area beer for you to enjoy while you discuss it. Beer first, Arrogant Bastard by Stone Brewing, which has a brewery in Richmond. It also is more famous for its initial brewery out in California, but it's a big company. Kate says it's the most delicious beer and my favorite."
You've had a few of those.
I have, and I would say Kate must be a hardcore, because that is a kick-in-the-ass beer.
It's a strong beer, yeah.
The motto or whatever slogan used to be, "You're not worthy."
Yeah, right.
And boy, so congrats to Kate. So in the case involved a murder of a Richmond family, It gave her nightmares and still does. She included a link, which I checked, and if we cover it, she believes we'll give the thoroughness and dignity the Harveys deserve. So these are Brian, Kathy, Harvey, and their daughters Stella and Ruby were murdered on January 1st, 2006 in a home invasion and robbery. And then the perpetrators who did this went on to murder three more people in their five-day spree. So these are nasty people.
Well, that's putting it mildly. Yeah, these are horrible killers.
This is just, I mean, the family, I think the kids are like 5 and 3 or something like that. They're little kids.
Oh.
Mom ran a toy store and dad was a musician. It was just, you know, regular people.
Yeah, home invasions are terrifying. There was that one that happened, was it in Connecticut, where the doctor was away from home and his wife and children were killed by these guys that invaded the home?
Yeah, well, he was home. He was almost killed, too.
Oh, okay. He was in the basement or something.
Yeah, they stabbed him and threw him down in the basement.
Then they took the wife out to the ATM to get money.
And yeah.
I don't know, but the little girls died in a fire, I think.
It's horrible.
Yeah. I watched a documentary on it, and really, it was horrible. I decided I don't want to cover it. It was so bad.
We thought about covering that.
We did, but it is a heartbreaker.
We'll look into this and see how much info we can accumulate.
Okay, yeah, I'm surprised I've never heard of this because it does sound like it's a crime that would get a lot of media attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then what year did that happen?
Well, it's 15 years ago.
Oh, so it's been a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kate. We'll definitely look into that.
And you bet.
I know we can get Arrogant Bastard right at our local store. I've seen it.
We can.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for listening today. And thank you for your feedback. We really appreciate that.
We sure do.
You're very kind. And we'll see you next time.
At the Quiet End.
At the Quiet End. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.